I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us in our ongoing quest to find the awe and wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words.
What I remember is that I didn't remember. I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't remember that I had just given birth to my son. I didn't remember my husband. And it got to the point where I started pushing him away and saying, "This man is not my husband."
Samina Ali is author of Pieces You'll Never Get Back, a memoir of unlikely survival. Delivering her first child at age 29 entailed 21 medical traumas, including a heart attack, multiple organ failures, traumatic brain injury. That she even lived is incredible. She was close to death even before she fell into a coma, and then, as she came out of that coma, her memory of recent years had evaporated. Samina suffered throughout her pregnancy from preeclampsia, a condition that medical personnel regularly screen expectant mothers for, but she showed none of the classic symptoms. Because there had been no diagnosis of preeclampsia, no interventions seemed called for. Yet, from the beginning of pregnancy, she sensed something was not quite right.
It was just something that kept nagging at me. Something, just an intuition that something wasn't quite right with the pregnancy. And I can't tell you where that feeling came from. I think when things happen to us, we know something is off. And I just had this sense that something was off.
Samina Ali was being cared for by some of the best doctors in the country at what was then UCSF Stanford Hospital. When she brought up these nagging apprehensions of a serious problem, her doctors pointed to normal test results to reassure her.
It's the most common disease of pregnancy. Unfortunately, there are just not enough doctors who know how to spot it. When women are pregnant and they go in monthly for their checkup, they usually dip a stick into their urine to check their liver. That's because they're checking for preeclampsia to see about the liver functions.
But preeclampsia doesn't always start with liver troubles. Those tests always came back normal for her, as was her blood pressure. But by month 7, symptoms had become tangible and striking. Severe bloating, migraines, seeing specks, vomiting, itching, pain on her right side. Still, healthcare providers explained away each individual symptom, not stepping far enough back, Samina says, to see these in the aggregate, as both she and her husband Scott had already done as non-experts. Their extensive reading had told them that she did have preeclampsia, a potentially fatal and actually not all that uncommon condition. In Samina's case, it quickly led to all the trauma I just described, and eventually to amnesia for this first-time mother. In this episode of Constant Wonder, we're going to explore how Samina fought to piece life back together, and how the world actually looked new to her again as she gradually reclaimed her role as a mother and as a writer. You see, a year before she found out she was pregnant, she had gotten a contract for her first novel, which she had nearly finished writing when she went into labor. With all the mounting symptoms that you had, all the pains in your body and in your head, did you go full term with this pregnancy?
I did. I delivered only a couple days before I was supposed to.
Take us now to that day, and I should qualify this, that any depiction of this event on that day is going to be mostly a story that you have reconstructed by leaning on people who were there and actually remember it. Because by and large, you generally have no intact memory of it.
I have very strong memories of certain aspects. My husband at the time and I had gone in for my final exam that afternoon and had pushed the OBGYN because we were convinced by that point that I did have eclampsia and preeclampsia. And the doctor still didn't take us seriously. He said, by next week at this time, you're going to be home, happy and safe with your newborn. And those were his final words to me. That very night, I went into labor and, you know, I wasn't safely home in a week. In fact, in a week's time, I was in the neuro ICU. So what I remember is at that point, I had basically given up on the medical establishment. And so I knew that no matter how often I had gone in and said, there's something wrong, you need to diagnose this, you need to treat me, that they weren't listening. And so by the time I was going into the hospital to deliver, I had accepted that I wouldn't make it through. And I remember my final prayer was, as long as my baby survives, it doesn't matter what happens to me. In the final stages of the delivery, I was having such immense pain in my head that it felt to me like my head was going to explode. I'd never experienced this level of pain before. Along with it, I had severe chest pain, and I was extremely nauseous. I was throwing up, and I kept asking the doctor, why am I experiencing more pain in my head and in my chest than I should be? I should be having that same pain down there because I'm delivering, but that pain is actually fine. I'm able to tolerate that, but I cannot tolerate this other pain. The doctor who was in the delivery wouldn't speak to me because at that point, he just dismissed me as a troublemaker. He would ignore me and then my husband would try to convey it and he would ignore my husband or he would bark at my husband and say, your wife's being dramatic. And so a nurse would have to convey everything back and forth. A third person in the room, which was ridiculous. For my chest pain, he'd ordered the nurse to give me Alka-Seltzer. And of course, I immediately threw that up. And it turned out that the chest pain was because I was having a heart attack. The head pain, which he ignored entirely, turned out to be a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which in about 70% of patients who have nothing else going on is deadly. It can kill you. I had a lot of other things going on. My blood pressure had shot up. I think there's a photo of it at like 270. I had liver failure. I had kidney failure. I had pulmonary edema. My blood stopped clotting. I was given multiple blood transfusions and my blood platelet count went down from the thousands to a record low of 7. So I had no clotting factors whatsoever.
The doctor was focusing on the details of delivery. He didn't appreciate an overdramatic mother, distracting from what he seemed to think was the real matter at hand. However, after the baby arrived, he did call in a colleague to offer reassurance to Samina and her husband.
After my son was born, a cardiologist came into the room. And everyone was focused on my son. My husband was taking photos. The nurses were cleaning him up. And the cardiologist came because I had been complaining that I was seeing doubled and tripled and quadruple. And, you know, and he was holding up fingers saying, how many fingers do I have up now? How many fingers do I have up now? And I was exhausted. And I didn't want to answer him. And I remember forcing myself to try to answer him because that's what you do. And while he was in the middle of his exam, I felt this overwhelming, it felt like the medication, the pain medication that I'd been begging the doctors for had finally arrived, but it was quite natural. It rose up in me, this sense of just everything going still, everything going numb, rising up in me. And finally, the chest pain went away and the pain in my head went away. And I remember just feeling such relief. And I don't remember it, but in my medical chart, the reason I was feeling such calm and relief from all of the pain that I was in at that moment was because I had a grand mal seizure, which is the worst seizure you can have, and it cut off oxygen to my brain for 30 seconds. And so my body was stiff and, you know, shaking. And at that point, there was a male nurse in the room, and he knocked my husband out of the room. The other nurses grabbed my newborn and took him down into the nursery, and I was given magnesium. But it was at that point that the doctor said, oh, maybe something was wrong. Maybe she was right in everything that she was telling us. The trauma in my head was so bad that when I did land in the neuro ICU, the neurologist suspected that I was having minor strokes, like little bursting stars inside my skull. It was expanding the tissue of my brain, and it just kept expanding it and expanding it until the ridges of my brain were pushed up against the inside of my skull, and the neurologist was asking permission to drill a hole in my head to relieve the excess fluid. And at that point, of course, I was on life support, and they believed that the life support was not keeping me alive. It was just extending the point at which I would simply die.
Looking back on the pain caused by her heart attack, her organ failure, her brain injury, then thinking about all of that pain subsiding, well, Samina often employs a metaphor she has drawn from her Islamic heritage, the story of Abraham's wife Hagar at the time soon after the birth of the boy Ishmael. Out of the earth, a miracle, a life-preserving spring of water arose at the site that would later become Mecca. So goes this ancient story as Samina told it to us. Water came forth in the very place where Hagar's young son Ishmael stamped his foot in a rage of thirst and hunger.
I think there is a reason I compare it to the spring of Zamzam that still flows in Mecca today and which people drink from when they go to Hajj. The reason I compare it to such a holy site is because I feel like in that moment, it did feel like God stepping in. I did have one foot in death's door, and I do think that part of me, I did experience the end. What that's done for me is it's taken away the fear of death.
A little later, Samina will expand on how meaningful this spring story is for her. Our focus right now, though, will be her experience waking up after 5 days in a coma.
I didn't have many of my mental or cognitive faculties, so I was blind in my right eye. I also had no depth perception, obviously. I couldn't, like when there was a tray of food in front of me, I didn't know how to reach for it because I didn't know where it was. I had amnesia, meaning I couldn't remember much of my history, but more importantly, I couldn't remember my more recent history. I had also forgotten my French. I was fluent in French. I've never been able to regain that. I had severe aphasia, which means if I was trying to say it's January in response to what my neurologist might ask, what's the date today? It might come out as it's a duck.
There were things that you did remember, however, and I think you remembered some things way back to growing up in India.
The earliest memories were there. So when my parents were in the room, I recognized my parents, my brothers, but that was it. My Urdu was still fluent because it's my native language, but my English was very broken. And the only Arabic I remembered were the Arabic prayers.
A native of India, Samina Ali had been born to Muslim parents. The family immigrated to Minneapolis when she was not yet 2 years old. For Samina, these Arabic prayers and the family's religious practices had been introduced to her early enough in life for her to recall their importance even while in the coma in the hospital, drifting in and out of consciousness.
I have one very distinct memory from when I was in the coma, and it's not even a full memory. It's almost a fragment of a memory that lasts just a couple seconds. And in it, I, of course, because I'm in a coma, am not aware that I'm in the neuro ICU. I am not aware that anything has happened to me. I'm not aware that I've delivered my son. I'm not aware of any of this. And all I am aware of is my mother's voice. And she's speaking to me in my ear, my right ear, and she's telling me, don't listen to the doctors. Don't believe them. We've taught you about God. Keep your faith in God. And she said that she and my dad were praying for me, that everyone in India, my relatives were praying for me, that everyone that we knew in Minneapolis was praying for me. And she said, you know, your dad and I, we've asked an imam to go to the top of the mountain in Hyderabad, to the top of Molali, with the Quran and to pray for you. And we've asked for that same level of grace that God showed to Abraham be shown to us. I remember how panicked that made me because the Quran is so lengthy. Why would they send an imam to the top of a mountain to read the Quran for me? Why are they taking these extreme measures? Why are they asking people to sacrifice lambs and sheep? What's happening? And of course, I couldn't move, and that made me even more panicked. And as I was sort of rising into that level of panic, everything started shutting down again, and I went back under.
These efforts of your family in your behalf, especially on that mountain, the hill, it's a holy shrine with thousands of mirrors there, the Mullah Ali, the hill. What firsthand experience do you have with this place?
There is a mountain in the city of Hyderabad, India, a pilgrimage for many of the locals, and it doesn't matter what religion you are. When we climb up that mountain, there are Hindus there, there are Muslims there, there are Christians there. It is a mountain that has for centuries been associated with miracles. So every time we went back to India, which was every single year when I was growing up, that was part of our pilgrimage, to climb up to the top of that mountain, to ask for our heart's desire. And it's a granite mountain. There's very little vegetation. And over the years, they've carved steps into the granite side. There are about 500 steps in it. And my brothers and I, of course, would race up those steps, and my parents would very slowly climb up behind us. And when you get to the top, there's a Sufi shrine. And the Sufi shrine inside has thousands and thousands of mirrors, big mirrors, small mirrors, all sorts of shapes and sizes, and they reflect the sun, and they just throw off these magnificent slices of light in all different directions. And within that shrine is a print of a palm engraved in a rock. And it goes back to the 15th century. There is a story that the Sufi saint Hazrat Ali had put his palm on a rock in order to help cure one of the eunuchs who was part of the palace. The eunuch was very, very ill, and the court had tried their hardest to try to save him, but they couldn't. On the night that he was expected to die, he had a dream that this Sufi saint, Hazrat Ali, had called him up to the mountain. And in the dream, he flew up to the top of the mountain. And he met Hazrat Ali there, and Hazrat Ali told him, I've heard your prayers. You'll wake up tomorrow and you'll be fine. He woke up the next day. He told the king about his dream. The king immediately took it seriously. They transported this eunuch up to the top of the mountain, and the handprint was indeed there, and indeed the eunuch survived and thrived. So when I became sick, of course, my parents were hoping for that same miracle.
So you know what it means to be a mother, You can imagine your medical crisis from the perspective of your parents. I'm sure you can imagine how terrifying it was for them knowing that they might lose a child.
To be told that I'm not going to survive, they were experiencing something that no parent wants to experience. For them, it was natural when they were facing that level of despair to turn to God. Their response, however, was very different. My dad turned to God, and he came away thinking that everything that had happened with me up until that point, the fact that the doctors had dismissed me, the fact that no one had diagnosed me correctly, the fact that I went into the delivery on the same night that this OBGYN was on call and refused to talk to me, he took all of these as signs that it was my time. And he tried to reconcile himself with that. My mom, on the other hand, she was going back and forth from, you know, my house to the hospital, and she was praying when she was at my house. And she remembers that it was during prayer one day when she put her head to the ground on the prayer mat that she felt this immense sense of peace rise up in her. And so she came back, and that's why she whispered into my ear, "Nothing is going to happen to you. Don't listen to the doctors." And she said, "I knew when I was praying and I felt that peace, I knew God was telling me that nothing's going to happen to you."
Samina Ali is author of Pieces You'll Never Get Back, a memoir of unlikely survival. In just a moment, she'll describe her relationship with her newborn, the infant she couldn't even remember having given birth to. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. In all of this discussion about you, I don't want to lose sight of the baby, whom you named Ishmael. You've already given details in our conversation, and they leave me thinking this, that that's got to be a direct reference to the son of Abraham and Hagar. Elaborate a little bit on the significance of that name for you.
I came to Ishmael because it is a name in Arabic that is Ismail. In the Quran, Ismail is Abraham's firstborn son with Hagar. And when Abraham's wife Sarah has Isaac, the Quranic story is that Sarah tells Abraham, you know, "I'm pregnant now. I don't need Hagar and your firstborn around." So Abraham takes Hagar and Ishmael off into the desert, and he leaves her there with a few dates and some water. And he starts walking away, and Hagar shouts out to him, "Has your God commanded you to do this?" And Abraham turns around and says, "Yes, he did." And in just what I find astounding courage, her response is, "Then I know it's meant to be and I'll survive." Of course, after a few days, the dates run out, the water runs out. Ishmael starts crying. She's running from hill to hill looking for water, looking for something to help. Ishmael stomps his foot on the ground and water streams up. And it's a spring that's still going. And every year when Muslims go to Hajj in Mecca, that is what they're doing. They're commemorating Abraham, they're commemorating Hagar, and they're commemorating Ishmael. And because Ishmael is a name that is from the Old Testament, of course, it's a name that belongs to all three of the monotheistic faiths. And so it was important to me to name him Ishmael as a sign of all of the heritage and the commonalities.
This infant Ishmael that you gave birth to was such a stranger to you when you awoke from your coma that you didn't even know that you had given birth, that you were expecting, that it was gone. And then it must be sad that Ishmael, your infant, wasn't well. The eclampsia had terrible effects on him.
Absolutely. He was blessed in the sense that he survived. Oftentimes when a woman does have eclampsia, and again, I had like the extreme form. So in those situations, an infant doesn't survive, and it's because the body of a pregnant woman assumes that the embryo growing inside of her is a foreign entity. It's almost like your body rejecting an organ if you've had an organ transplant. So the body constantly sends out different mechanisms to expel the baby, and oftentimes women will have miscarriages, or their baby will be stillborn, or it will be very sickly. And so we were very blessed that he came out. He came out very malnutritioned. He had some minor health issues, but he survived. He survived the whole thing.
Normal functioning of the internal organs returned for Samina Ali after about 5 days in a coma. And it wasn't long after that when she began to wake up. Leaving the hospital for home, accompanied by her mother, she was still quite uncoordinated, stumbled a lot when trying to walk, didn't have visual depth perception, and still couldn't remember the birth of her newborn son, Ishmael. I asked her how she came to terms with parenting a baby she had no memory of.
There's an assumption in society that women are naturally nurturing, that we are caregivers, that as soon as we give birth, we will automatically become mothers. And what I found in this is that that's not true. And we have to create bonds with our child. And I think that's why when a woman nurses, she releases the hormones that she does that bond her to her child. For me, that was taken to the extreme because I had no memory of my son. And I, in the beginning, honestly thought of him as a competitor. Because in the beginning, when I couldn't take care of him and I was in my house convalescing, my mother stayed with us in order to help care for our newborn. And she was the one who was watching him and watching me, feeding him and feeding me, changing his diapers, helping me to the bathroom, you know, all of those things. And my son looked to me to be gobbling up her attention, taking up so much of her time when I needed it. And because I didn't remember that he was my son, and because I didn't have a sense that he's an infant and needed care, he just seemed like some entity that was competing. And I was in survival mode and I was in my animal brain. And I remember yelling at my mom and saying, you know, you've got to stop looking after him. I'm your child, not him. You've got to take care of me. So it was a very difficult experience.
How long was it before you started to assume those stereotypical nurturing emotions and feelings that we attribute to motherhood and we think is organic and natural?
I would say it was several months into being a mother. Now, you have to remember that my brain was so broken at the time that I wasn't able to really track time. And so it's difficult for me to name a particular time. For me, every touchstone is after an event rather than, you know, a monthly calendar. So I remember it happened because I had gone in for an appointment with a neurologist. My brain still looked exactly the same on the MRI scan as it had when I was in the hospital, and it had already been weeks and there was no improvement. And they didn't think that I would ever be able to speak again, fluidly. They didn't think I'd be able to think again or to imagine, to project a future. You know, those things that we take to be human attributes. I remember during that session, I kept saying, well, what about writing? When will I be able to write? And I pushed him to the point where he said, you're never going to be able to write again. It's just not possible. When he said that, I was crushed, of course, but at the same time, there was a rebellious part inside of me that thought, why am I even asking him? Why am I even turning to a doctor? When I was pregnant, the entire time I kept coming to the doctors and saying, there's something wrong. There's something wrong and there's something wrong. And every single time I came in, they said, there's nothing wrong. You're healthy. You're fine. We're not going to take these red flags seriously. You know, they dismissed me. They thought I was hysterical. And I thought, no, I knew something was wrong and they didn't help me. So why should I believe them now when they tell me that I'm never going to recover? I'm going to recover. After that appointment, I went home and I tried my best to begin to do the very things that the doctor told me I would never be able to do. I tried to start writing and I tried to start bonding with my son, which at first meant just acting like a mother, bathing him with the help of my mom, of course, feeding him, doing the things that I had been watching my mom do over the months and saying, okay, I'm going to try these things now myself. And it was through the performance, through the acting out of motherhood that as I started to create more neural pathways, I started to understand and really bond with my son. And that bonding is what creates love.
As you started to engage more and more with your son maternally, learning how to care and tend to the needs of this total stranger, even more of a stranger than the typical newborn, because you didn't even have a recollection of the pregnancy, to say nothing of the delivery. Well, that relationship, clearly it began to grow. And you have quite an interesting perspective on how he, even as a small child, he helped you to come back from the coma, to regain specific functions. He helped you heal.
After I started to bond with him and after I started to become and grow into motherhood, I felt more attached to him than I think I would have if I hadn't had this experience, because I was going through many of the same rites of passage alongside of him. So when I would see his attempts to walk in the beginning, I had a real inside knowledge of how difficult it is to walk and how much coordination, how much stamina, and how much of different parts of your brains go into a human being able to stand up and be on two legs and to walk down the street, these things that we take for granted. I had so much patience for him, so much compassion. Same thing with when he was learning to speak. Any rite of passage that he was going through, I felt like I had inside knowledge. I was there right beside him. We were on this journey together. So he was both an inspiration and a companion.
Samina Ali is the author of Pieces You'll Never Get Back, a memoir of unlikely survival. In just a moment here on Constant Wonder, we're going to find out how acting on her love of writing may have been the most useful prescription for the treatment of her amnesia, even if it was a prescription the doctor never ordered. I'm Marcus Smith. I want to shine a spotlight on another incredible show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called Top of Mind, and it resonates in a big way with those who want to engage with the important, tough issues facing our communities, but who are dismayed by polarizing and divisive approaches to these issues. Each week, Top of Mind tackles one tough topic. Award-winning host Julie Rose talks with guests about complex, challenging perspectives, and the Top of Mind experience doesn't aim at persuading you to change your mind. Instead, it opens a door for empathy and clarity in the interest of becoming better citizens and kinder neighbors. Listen to Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.
I'd been writing since I was little. It was how I was able to understand my very confusing world because I did part of my schooling in India, part of my schooling in the U.S. Every time my parents dropped me into school in India, my classmates would say, "Oh, there's that American girl, she's back." And every time I was dropped into school in the U.S. in a white suburb of Minneapolis, all of my classmates would say, "Oh, there's that Indian girl, she's back." And so it was a difficult experience because I was learning English and French in one place, and then I was learning Urdu and Arabic in the other place, and I was learning Indian history, and then I was learning American history. And because I was moving back and forth, I didn't really have any friends because everyone knew she's going to be gone in 6 months. You know, why would you become friends with her? And no one could identify with me. So I, as a very lonely child, turn inward and do what a lot of children do when they're feeling lonely, at least before TikTok, which was to read. And I read a lot of books and I found experiences in books that I could identify with. And I found characters who became friends. Remember, you know, we have Bollywood, which means that I grew up with a lot of Hindi movies. So I was deep into story and narrative growing up.
Post-coma, you're back at home. You returned to a novel that you had been working on. And this was one of the most alienating experiences, I think, in the whole book as I read your memoir, that this thing that you had poured so much attention into, so much care and love, was a stranger to you. What happened with that novel?
I remember going back and reading a couple pages of the manuscript, and I didn't really recognize what I'd written, the scenes, and I thought, oh, I just probably forgot. And so I scrolled to other scenes and then still other scenes and still other scenes, and I couldn't remember any of this book. It was as though I had just taken a book out of a bookshelf and opened it up and was randomly reading it. It was not my work. It was deeply frightening when I finally realized that I couldn't remember this book that I'd been working on for years. I did what my very broken brain at the time told me to do, which is get rid of it, delete it, don't look at it anymore because it's too scary. It represented everything I had lost. It represented that I had lost my former self. It represented that I had lost myself as a writer, as a thinker, as a storyteller. It was too big to keep.
Is it gone?
It's entirely gone.
Do you have any recollection of plot, characters, concept?
I had been at 19 in an arranged marriage, and I was writing the novel based on the experience of that arranged marriage. The storyline still there because it was part of my experience. After I deleted everything I had already written and I started new, that story, of course, was still there. But I have to say that the way I look at it now is very different. When I was writing the original manuscript, I had come to it with a great deal of pain. And I think I was writing it almost as therapy, trying to get beyond that experience. And when I came back to it, so many of my memories had been wiped clean. And what is interesting about memories is they're always attached to emotion. So when I went back to write my novel this time after the brain damage, because so many of my memories had been wiped clean, and because those memories then came back to me when the amnesia started to lift, they came back as episodic without the emotion attached to them. So I was able to then write the book with a great deal of distance, and it then started to feel like a real novel to me. And I was able to give the main character who represents my first husband a level of compassion that I couldn't have given him and wasn't able to give him the first time I was writing the book.
And that book, you successfully completed it? Whatever came of wanting to write that novel?
I did successfully complete it. It went out into the world. The title is Madras on Rainy Days. It's won awards and has been published both here and internationally. So I'm really, really happy that it was successful.
This novel is like the backbone of your recovery, I think, because you had been either forewarned or told what to expect by the neurologist in terms of what you may or may not be able to recover after the coma. And somehow, this writing process helped you reconstruct stuff.
When I went to my follow-up appointment and the neurologist told me I wouldn't ever write again, and I became determined to prove him wrong, writing for me has always been a spiritual act. It's for me a place of meditation. It's a place of prayer. Growing up as a Muslim, we believe that the Quran is God's word. We have certain rituals. If I come and I read the Quran, I should be covered. I should be clean. I can't drop it. I can't put my foot on it. You know, I'm barefoot when I'm coming close to it. There's a sense that the word is sacred. And growing up, that didn't just apply to the Quran or to any holy book. It just applied to words in general. Even if I dropped a pen and it touched my foot, I was taught that I should put the pen on my, you know, across my eyes and then kiss it and show respect for the pen, show respect for the book, show respect for the written word. And growing up like that, I always believed that the word was connected to God. And so not being able to write felt like such a disconnection from my own spirituality and a disconnection from the divine. It was an extremely painful and lonely process. But so many of my neurons had died because of the multiple strokes and the brain damage. And the doctor, the neurologist, had said that the process of recovery would require that I begin to create new neural pathways. What they don't tell you is how painful that can be. When I went to the computer, my aphasia would trip me up, or I wasn't able to use my imagination because I didn't have the higher mental capacities anymore. When I was pushing myself like that, it would result in a massive headache. And I remember very vividly turning in my chair at my desk, turning away from the desk and just allowing my body to fall on the ground, curled up in a fetus position because my head hurt so much. And then I would slowly crawl to the bed and get in it. And I did this over and over and over again, and those writing sessions in the beginning were probably only about 5 or 10 minutes long. And they slowly, gradually lengthened in time. But the reason I was having such massive headaches was because I was creating those neural pathways again. And I was forcing my brain to do things that it wasn't able to do anymore. So it was the process of writing and writing and writing day after day, month after month, and then months into years that helped me to recover much of what I had lost.
When he saw Samina's extraordinary progress, far more progress and relearning than he had thought would be possible for her, well, her neurologist wanted to know how she had done it.
He doesn't take credit for my recovery. And I said, I don't know what I did. I can tell you that I wrote a book in this time. And so we talked about the possibility that it was writing the book that might have helped me to really recover a lot of my neural pathways.
This doctor, Wade Smith by name, showed a lot of humility in the face of Samina's achievement, and he encouraged her to take on something kind of like an assignment. It was an idea of his that would culminate in Pieces You'll Never Get Back, her memoir.
He was the one who said, you know, it occurs to me that not only have you gone to such an extreme and come back, but you happen to also be a writer. And he said, you know, as a neurologist, we can tell patients, this is what you're going to experience, and this is what you're experiencing with brain damage, but we're only telling you these things from the outside, having read textbooks. But you can tell us from the inside what it's actually like. He was the very first one to suggest that I write this book.
The process of writing gradually became easier for Samina, but the discoveries she made while writing, well, those sometimes stopped her in her tracks. Because she couldn't remember everything that had happened to her over the course of her long recovery, she often leaned on Dr. Smith to interpret for her what do those details all mean that had been included on her medical charts.
Every time I went in, I left really troubled because being brain damaged protected me from understanding everything that I had lost. Being brain damage prevented me from knowing that I was brain damaged. And there's grace in that. So when I started to interview my neurologist, Dr. Wade Smith, he would tell me things that I didn't know. He told me that his worst fear when I was in the neuro ICU was that my brain was going to keep expanding to the point where it would fall into the opening of the spinal cord and that I would die of brain death. I didn't know this. And I walked home shaking. And I remember thinking, why am I even doing this? Why do I keep going back to the scene of the accident? Why keep circling this? Maybe it's best that I don't know. And that's what my dad does, of course. He doesn't want me to talk about it. He's never talked about it. Because he thinks that there is grace. There is God's grace in me not knowing.
You've used the phrase cracking the code. And when you use that phrase, I take it that you're bracketing in a couple of things. One is going back to the medical records. As somebody who is not a medical professional, you're trying to understand the lingo, the language, the jargon. You're trying to crack that code. In doing this, you're also trying to crack the code of what happened to you.
I think that as humans, one of the things that our brain does is try to put a larger meaning to our lives. And we string together memories and experiences and emotions, and we come up with the story of our life, right? We are the stars of that story. Cracking the code to me means that when we start putting together that story of our life, that we do so in a way that is actually compassionate with ourselves. I think many of us can be very cruel to ourselves. We'll tell ourselves, oh, this isn't going to happen because I've always been a loser or I've always had bad luck. We tell ourselves these terrible stories about who we are. What cracking the code really means is and understanding that, yes, sure, none of us are perfect. I'm not perfect. This book isn't perfect. I still have areas in my brain that aren't functioning properly, but that's what it means to be human. We're here and we're endeavoring and we're pushing forward and creating our stories. I don't see my story as tragic. I have, of course, lost a great deal in the process over the years. I still don't have many of my memories. I still have moments of aphasia when I'm writing. When I wrote Pieces You'll Never Get Back, I still caught mistakes because different words still continue to come out than intended. But all of us endure seasons of darkness and seasons of difficulty. And all of us have to make our way through those seasons. And we feel so alone when we do. But for me, this is a story of hope. This is a story of miracles. This is a story that shows us that we're not alone in those dark moments like we feel we are. All of these years that I've been given are bonus years, and I don't look toward death anymore with that same dread and fear that I used to, and that I think many people do. And I think that in this culture, in American culture, people don't know how to talk about death, and they don't know how to talk about grief, and they don't know how to talk about mourning, and we're urged to move on and get ahead. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, until this book came out, I didn't speak about this story to people. When I started sending links of the book to many of my friends, they started to write me back and say, I didn't even know this happened, because it happened 20 odd years ago. So the friends I've made since didn't know. And that's because so often in the early days when I would mention even the slightest bit of what I went through, people would shut me down. They didn't want to talk about it. That's not dinner conversation. I remember one person being very angry with me and saying that people are scared to talk about God, about spirituality, about the meaning of these things. And so I stopped telling people, and I tried all of these years to just be ordinary, to just have the same material experience that everyone else is having. This isn't a tragic story. This is a story of wonder. This is a story of awe.
My favorite scene in the book, it's a scene that for me poignantly shows the wonder in this story. You are coming out of Dr. Smith's office for the last time, and actually this was only the second time that you had been seen by him, twice altogether, once in the ICU, and now this second time leaving his office as a graduating patient.
My last appointment with my neurologist was about 3.5 years after I had delivered my son. And by then, every time I had gone in for my follow-ups, I had never been told, oh yeah, you're in the clear now, you don't need to come back. Even that day when I went in, I wasn't expecting to be cleared. And yet, this miracle happened finally when I had given up. And the neurologist showed me my MRI scans and said all of my injuries had calcified. And we went through the neurological exam that we did every single time. How many fingers am I holding up? Can you hop on one leg? Can you do this? Can you do that? And I passed. I passed everything for the first time. And I could remember words, which I couldn't remember in previous exams because of my short-term memory loss. And when he pronounced that I'm using the word recover in quotes, that I was as good as it's going to get. I always thought when I hear those words, when the neurologist finally tells me that I've actually recovered, I'm going to feel such bravado. I'm going to feel such conceit because a part of me was really trying to prove the doctors wrong, right? I'm going to do this and I'm going to show you. None of that came up. There was this overwhelming silence inside of me and an overwhelming sense of peace and gratitude and awe, to be honest. I walked home as though I was rebirthed, and everything just took on this incredible, I didn't even know how to explain it. It felt like the sky was twinkling and the leaves on the trees were sparkling. And I picked up my son and we walked home and I paused with him everywhere. We examined the sidewalk. We ran our hands along a tree just to feel the bark. We picked up ladybugs. We examined butterflies. It was just like seeing the world for the first time. It was a magical, magical experience.
Samina Ali is author of Pieces You'll Never Get Back, a memoir of unlikely survival. She's also author of the award-winning novel Madras on Rainy Days. This episode was produced by Mamie Teebles and Tenery Taylor, sound designed by James Call. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.